Side 11, Domes of Fire, The Tomoli, Book 1, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 405. Chapter 26.
Please take my word for it, Your Majesty, Zelasta said to the skeptical Sarabian. It was most definitely not a normal phenomenon.
You're the expert, Zelasta, Sarabian said dubiously. My instincts all tell me to look for a natural explanation first, though. A cloud passing in front of the sun, perhaps.
It's evening, Sarabian, Elana pointed out. The sun's already gone down.
That would sort of weaken that particular explanation, wouldn't it? You've all seen this before?
Most of us, Your Majesty, Oscania assured him. I even saw it once myself, on shipboard, and there was nothing between me and the sun.
I think we'll have to accept the testimony of our lean friends here. They've had experiences with this particular manifestation before.
Stupid, Sparhawk muttered.
I beg your pardon,
Sarabian said mildly.
Sorry, Your Majesty, Sparhawk apologized. I wasn't referring to you, of course. It's our visitor who's not very intelligent. If you set out to spy on someone, you don't announce your presence with drum rolls and trumpet fanfares.
He's done it before, Sparhawk, Patriarch Emban reminded him. He put in an appearance in Archimandrite Monsel's study in Darsus, if you remember.
Maybe he doesn't know he's doing it, Calton suggested.
When he first went to work for Martell, Adas used to try to sneak around and spy on people. That's why Martell had to finally hire Krager.
Who's Adas? Sarabian asked.
A fellow we used to know, Your Majesty, Calton replied. He wasn't of much use as a spy. Everybody for 100 yards in any direction knew when Adas was around. He didn't believe in bathing, so he had a distinctive fragrance.
Is that at all possible?
Vanyan asked Sophrenia.
Could Calton have actually come up with a right answer?
Vanyan, Calton objected.
Sorry, Calton. That didn't come out exactly the way I'd intended.
Seriously, though, Sophrenia, could our visitor be unaware of the shadow he's casting?
Anything's possible, I suppose, dear one.
A visual stink? Ulof suggested incredulously.
I don't know if I'd use that exact term, but... Sophrenia looked at Zelasta. Is it possible?
It would explain the phenomenon, he replied after pondering the notion for a moment. The gods are remarkable, not only in the depth of their understanding, but also in their limitations. It could very well be that our visitor doesn't know that we can smell him when he pays a call. If I may borrow Sir Ulof's metaphor, he may actually believe that he's totally invisible to us, that his spying is going unnoticed.
Bevier was shaking his head. We always talk about it right after it happens, he disagreed. He'd have heard us, so he has to know that he's giving himself away.
Not necessarily, Bevier, Calton disagreed. Adas didn't know that he smelled like a cesspool, and it's not really the sort of thing one admits to himself. Maybe this shadow's the same sort of thing, a kind of socially unacceptable offensiveness, like bad breath or poor table manners.
There's a fascinating idea. Patriarch Emban laughed. We could extrapolate a complete book of divine etiquette from this one single incident.
To what purpose, Your Grace? Oscania asked him.
The noblest of purposes, Your Excellency. The greater understanding of God. Isn't that why we're here?
I'm not sure that a dissertation on the table manners of the gods would significantly advance the sum of human knowledge, Emban,
Vanyan observed.
Might we prevail on Your Majesty to smooth our way into the inner circles of your government?
Smooth or rough, Lord Vanyan, Sarabian grinned. I'll insert you into the ministries. After I've straightened Pandya Subad out, I'll take on the other ministers, one by one or row by row. I think it's time they all found out just exactly who's in charge here.
He suddenly laughed with delight.
I'm so glad you decided to stop by, Elana. You and your friends have made me realize that I've been sitting on absolute power for all these years, and that it's never occurred to me to use it. I think it's time to pull it out, dust it off, and wave it around just a bit.
Oh, dear, Oscania said, his face suddenly filled with chagrin. What have I done?
"We got this year problem, Stragan," Ka'alador drawled in Alenic. "These year Yaller brothers of ourn ain't tooken with the notion of steppin' cross no social boundaries."
"Please, Ka'alador," Stragan said. "Spare me the folksy preamble. Get to the point."
"'Tain't really natural, Stragan."
"Do you mind?"
Stragan, Talon, and Ka'alador were meeting in a cellar near the waterfront. It was mid-morning, and the local thieves were beginning to stir. As you've already discovered, the Brotherhood here in Mathurian's afflicted with a caste system, Ka'alador continued. The Thieves' Guild doesn't talk to the swindlers, and the Beggars' Guild doesn't talk to the whores, except in the line of business, of course, and the Murderers' Guild is totally outcast.
"Now that there's real unnatural," Talon observed.
"Don't do that, Talon," Stragan told him. "One of you is bad enough. I couldn't bear two. Why are the murderers so despised?"
"Because they violate one of the basic precepts of Tamil culture." Ka'alador shrugged. "They're paid assassins, actually, and they don't bow and scrape to their victims before they cut their throats. The concept of courtesy overwhelms Tamils. They don't really object to the notion of someone murdering noblemen for hire. It's the rudeness of it all that upsets them." Ka'alador shook his head. "That's one of the reasons so many Tamil thieves get caught and beheaded. It's considered impolite to run away."
"Unbelievable," Talon murmured. "It's worse than we thought, Stragan. If these people don't talk to each other, we'll never get any information out of them."
"I think I warned you not to expect too much here in Mathurian, my friends," Ka'alador reminded them. "Are the rest of the guilds afraid of the murderers?" Stragan asked.
"Oh, yes," Ka'alador replied.
"We'll start from there, then. What's the general feeling about the Emperor?"
"Awe, generally, and a level of adoration that hovers right on the verge of outright worship."
"Good. Get in touch with the Murderers' Guild. When Talon brings you the word, have the cutthroats round up the heads of the other guilds and bring them to the palace."
"What are we a-fixin' to do here, my friend?"
"I'll speak with the Emperor and see if I can persuade him to make a speech to our brothers."
Stragan shrugged. "Have you lost your mind?"
"Of course not. Tamils are completely controlled by custom, and one of those customs is that the Emperor can suspend customs."
"Were you able to follow that?" Ka'alador asked Talon. "I think he lost me on that sharp turn right there at the end."
"Let's see if I've got this straight," Ka'alador said to the blonde Thalesian. "You're going to violate every known propriety of the criminal culture here in Mathurian by having the murderers kidnap the leaders of the other guilds."
"Yes,"
Stragan admitted. "Then you're going to have them all taken to the palace compound, where they're absolutely forbidden to go."
"Yes."
"Then you're going to ask the Emperor to make a speech to a group of people whose very existence he's not even supposed to know about."
"That's more or less what I had in mind."
"And the Emperor's going to command them to suspend eons-old custom and tradition and start cooperating with each other?"
"Is there some problem with that?"
"No, not really. I just wanted to be sure I had it all down straight in my mind, that's all."
"See to it, would you, old boy?" Stragan asked. "I'd probably better go talk with the Emperor."
Cifrini aside. "You're being childish, you know," she said. Sala's eyes bulged.
"How dare you!" he almost screamed.
The Styric Elder's face had gone white.
"You forget yourself, Elder Sala," Zalasta told the outraged man. "Counselor Sophrenia speaks for the Thousand. Will you defy them and the gods they represent?"
"The Thousand are misguided," Sala blustered. "There can never be an accommodation between Styricum and the Pig-Eaters."
"That's for the Thousand to decide," Zalasta told him in a flinty tone.
"But look at what the Aline barbarians have done to us," Sala said, his voice choked with outrage.
"You've lived out your whole life here in the Styric Quarter in Mathurian, Elder Sala," Zalasta said. "You've probably never even seen an Aline."
"I can read, Zalasta."
"I'm delighted to hear it. We're not really here for discussion, however. The High Priestess of Afriel is conveying the instruction of the Thousand. Like it or not, you're compelled to obey."
Sala's eyes filled with tears.
They've murdered us, he choked.
You seem to be in remarkably good condition for a man who's been murdered, Sala, Sephrenia told him. Tell me, was it painful?
You know what I mean, priestess.
Ah, yes, she said. That tiresome steric compulsion to expropriate pain. Someone on the far side of the world stabs a steric, and you start to bleed. You sit here in Matherian, in protected luxury, feeling sorry for yourself, and secretly consumed with a gnawing envy that you're being denied martyrdom. Well, if you want to be a martyr so badly, Sala, I can arrange it for you.
Sephrenia was coldly angry with this babbling fool.
The Thousand has made its decision, she said flatly. I don't really have to explain it to you, but I will, so that you can convey the decision to your followers. And you will explain it, Sala. You'll be very convincing about it, or I'll replace you.
I hold my position for life, he declared defiantly.
Precisely my point.
Her tone was ominous. He stared at her.
You wouldn't, he gasped.
Try me. Sephrenia had wanted to say that to someone for years. She found it quite satisfying. It goes like this, Sala. Feel free to stop me if I start going too fast for you. The Alenes are savages who are looking for an excuse to kill every Styric they see. If we don't assist them in this crisis, we'll be handing them that excuse on a velvet cushion. We will assist them, because if we don't, they'll slaughter every Styric on the Eosian continent. We don't want them to do that, do we?
But,
Sala, if you say but to me one more time, I'll obliterate you.
She was startled to discover just how enjoyable it was to behave like an Alene.
I've given you the instruction of the Thousand, and the Thousand speaks for the gods. The matter is not open for discussion, so quit trying to snivel or wriggle your way out of this. You will obey, or you will die. Those are your options. Choose quickly. I'm in a bit of a hurry.
Even Zelasta seemed shocked at that.
Your goddess is cruel, Counselor Sephrenia, Sala accused.
She hit him before she even thought about it, her hand and arm seeming to move all on their own. She had spent generations with the Pandion Knights, and she knew how to get her shoulder behind the blow. It was more than an ineffectual slap. She caught him solidly on the point of the chin with the heel of her hand, and he reeled back, his eyes glazed.
Sephrenia began to intone the words of the deadly incantation, her hands moving quite openly in the accompanying gestures. I won't do that, Sephrenia, Afriel's voice rang sharply in her mind. I know, Sephrenia threw back the thought. I'm just trying to get his attention, that's all.
Sala gasped as he realized what she was doing. Then he screamed and fell to his knees, blubbering and begging for mercy.
Will you do as I have commanded you to do? She snapped.
Yes, priestess, yes. Please don't kill me.
I have suspended the spell, but I have not cancelled it. I can finish it at any time. Your heart lies in my fist, Sala. Keep that firmly in mind the next time you feel an urge to insult my goddess. Now get up and go do as you're told. Come along, Zelasta. The smell of self-pity in here nauseates me.
You've grown hard, Sephrenia,
Zelasta accused when they were back out in the narrow streets of the Styric Quarter.
I was bluffing, my old friend, she told him. Afriel would never have responded to the spell.
She touched her forearm gingerly.
Do you happen to know where I might find a good physician, Zelasta? I think I've just sprained my wrist.
Not very impressive, are they?
Ulof suggested, as he, Tinian, and Kring walked back across the neatly trimmed grounds of the Imperial compound toward the Alene Castle.
Truly, Kring agreed. They seem to spend all their time thinking about parades.
The three of them were returning from their meeting with the Imperial High Command.
They're all show, the Domi concluded. There's no substance to them.
Uniformed courtiers, Ulof dismissed the Tommel General Staff. I'll agree. Tinian concurred. The Aetons are the real military force in Tamale. Decisions are made by the government,
and the general staff simply passes those decisions on to the Eitan commanders. I began to have some doubts about the effectiveness of the Imperial Army when they told me that rank is hereditary. I wouldn't want to rely on them in the event of an emergency.
That's God's own truth, friend Tinian, Kring said. Their cavalry general took me to the saddles and showed me what they call horses here.
He shuddered.
Bad? Ulof asked. Worse than bad, friend Ulof. Their mounts wouldn't even make good plow horses. I wouldn't have believed that horses could get that fat. Anything faster than a walk would kill the poor beasts.
Are we agreed, then? Tinian asked them. The Imperial Army is totally useless?
I think you're flattering them, Tinian, Ulof replied.
We'll have to phrase our report rather carefully, the Alcyone knight told his companions. We probably shouldn't offend the Emperor. Could we say, under-trained?
That's the truth, certainly, Kring answered.
How about unversed in modern tactics and strategy?
No argument there, Ulof grunted.
Poorly equipped?
That's not exactly true, friend Tinian, Kring disagreed. Their equipment is of very good quality. It's probably the best 12th century equipment I've ever seen.
All right, Tinian laughed. How about archaic weaponry?
I could accept that, the Domi conceded.
You'd rather not mention fat, lazy, stupid, or inept, I gather?
Ulof asked.
That might be just a shade undiplomatic, Ulof.
True, though, Ulof said mournfully.
Pandya Subot did not approve. Emban and Vanyan could sense that, although the Prime Minister's face and manner remained diplomatically bland. Emperor Sarabian had, as promised, spoken at length with his Prime Minister, and Pandya Subot was going out of his way to be cooperative and to conceal his true feelings.
The details are very commonplace, my lords, he said deprecatingly. But then the details of day-to-day government always are, aren't they?
Of course, Pandya, Emban shrugged. But when taken in the mass, the accretion of detail conveys the sense of governing style, wouldn't you say? From what I've seen so far this morning, I've already reached certain conclusions.
Oh? Subot's tone was neutral.
The guiding principle here seems to be the protection of the Emperor, Emban told him. That principle is very familiar to me, since it's identical to the one that dominates our thinking in Kyrellos. The government of the Church exists almost entirely to protect the Archprelate.
Perhaps, Your Grace, but you'll have to admit that there are differences.
Oh, of course. But the fact that Emperor Sarabian's not as powerful as Archprelate Dolmont doesn't really change things. Subot's eyes widened slightly, but he instantly gained control of his expression. I realize that the concept is alien to you, Pandya, Emban continued smoothly. But the Archprelate speaks for God, and that makes him the most powerful man on earth. That's an Aline perception, of course, and it may have little or nothing to do with reality. So long as we all believe it, though, it is true. That's what those of us in church government do. We devote a great deal of our effort to making sure that all Alenes continue to believe that Dolmont speaks for God. So long as they believe that, the Archprelacy is safe.
The fat little churchman considered it.
If you don't mind an observation, Pandya Subot, your central problem here in Mathurian stems from the fact that you Tamils have a secular turn of mind. Your church has been diminished, probably because you can't bring yourselves to accept the notion that any authority might equal or exceed that of the Emperor. You've erased the element of faith from your national character. Skepticism is all very well and good, but it tends to get out of hand. After you've applied it to God, or your gods, it starts to spill over, and people begin to question other things as well. The rightness of government, imperial wisdom, the justice of the tax system, that sort of thing. In the most perfect of worlds, the Emperor would be deified, and church and state would become one.
He laughed in a self-deprecating little way.
Sorry, Pandya Subot. I didn't mean to preach. It's an occupational compulsion, I suppose. The point is that both Tamils and Alenes have made the same mistake. You didn't make your emperor a god, and we didn't make our archprelate an emperor. We've both cheated the people by placing an incomplete authority over them. They deserved better of us. But I can see that you're busy, and my stomach's telling me rather pointedly that it's lunchtime. We'll talk again. Soon. Coming, Lord Vanyan?
You don't actually believe what you just said, do you, Emban?
Vanyan murmured as the two Alines left the ministry. Probably not, Emban shrugged. But we're going to have to do something to widen the crack in that stone shell around Subat's mind. I'm sure that the Emperor's offer to have his head docked opened his eyes a bit. But until he starts actually thinking, instead of simply plodding along the well-worn paths of his preconceptions, we are not going to get anything out of him. Despite his general disapproval of us, he's still the most important man in the government, and I'd rather have him working for us than against us. Do you suppose we could step right along, Vanyan? I'm definitely getting hungry.
It should be blue, though,
Danae was saying. She sat with Myr in Emperor Sarabian's lap, looking directly into his eyes.
For an Aline, yes. But...
The Emperor sounded dubious.
Right,
she agreed.
Tamil skin tone would be better with...
But not red-red, though. More scarlet. Perhaps even...
No, maroon's too dark. It's a ball, not a...
We don't wear dark clothes at funerals. We wear...
Really? That's a very interesting notion. Why do you...
It's considered insulting to...
The dead don't really mind, Sarabian. They're busy someplace else.
Can you even begin to follow them? Ilana murmured to Sparhawk.
Sort of. They're both thinking about the same thing, so they don't have to finish sentences.
Emperor Sarabian laughed delightedly.
You're the most stimulating conversationalist I've ever met, Your Royal Highness, he said to the little girl in his lap.
Thank you, Your Imperial Majesty, she replied.
You're not so bad yourself, you know.
Danae, Ilana said sharply.
Oh, Mother, Sarabian and I are just getting to know each other.
I don't suppose... Sarabian's tone was speculative.
I'm afraid not, Your Majesty, Danae replied. I'm not being disrespectful, but the Crown Prince is much too young for me. People gossip when the wife's older than the husband. He's a sweet-natured baby, though. But I've already decided who I'm going...
You have? So young?
It avoids confusion later on. Girls get silly when they reach the marrying age. It's better to decide those things while you've still got your wits about you, isn't it, Mother?
Ilana blushed suddenly.
Mother started setting traps for my father when she was about my age,
Danae confided to the Emperor of Tamale.
Did you, Ilana? Sarabian asked.
Well, yes, but it's not nice to talk about it in public.
He didn't mind being trapped, Mother, Danae said. At least not after he'd gotten used to the idea.
All in all, they make a fairly good set of parents.
Except when Mother starts throwing her rank around.
That will do, Princess Danae,
Ilana said in her official tone.
You see what I mean?
Danae grinned at the Emperor.
Your daughter's going to be a remarkably gifted queen, Sarabian complimented them.
Alenia is going to be a lucky kingdom to have the two of you on the throne, one right after another. The problem with hereditary succession has always been those lamentable lapses in talent. A great king or emperor is almost inevitably succeeded by a hopeless incompetent.
What's the customary procedure here in Tamale, Sarabian?
Ilana asked. I know that you have 9 wives. Does your firstborn become the crown prince, no matter what the race of his mother?
Oh, no, certainly not. The throne descends to the firstborn son of the first wife. She's always a Tamil, since a Tamil princess is always the first one a crown prince marries. I was married at the age of 2, actually. I married my other wives right after I was crowned emperor. It was a group ceremony, 8 brides and 1 bridegroom. That eliminates jealousies and arguments about rank. I was absolutely exhausted the following morning.
You mean that... Oh, yes, it's required. It's another way to avoid those jealousies I mentioned. And it all has to be finished by sunrise.
How do they decide who's first?
Ilana sounded very interested.
I have no idea. Maybe they rolled dice for the privilege.
There were 4 royal bedchambers on each side of a long corridor. I was obliged to go down that endless hallway and to pay a call on each of my new brides. It killed my grandfather. He wasn't a young man when he ascended the throne, and the exertion was too much for him.
Do you suppose we could change the subject?
Sparhawk asked.
Prude,
Ilana chided him.
I wonder if Dolmont would let me have more than 1 husband,
Danae mused.
Never mind,
Sparhawk told her firmly. The others arrived, and they all gathered around a large table set with a lunch consisting of unfamiliar delicacies. "How did you find Subot, Your Grace?" Sarabian asked the primate of Usera.
"We went to his offices, and there he was, Your Majesty."
"Amban," Sophronia chided the fat little churchman, who was looking suspiciously at an undefinable meat course.
"Sorry, Your Majesty," Amban apologized. "Your Prime Minister still seems to be a bit set in his ways."
"You noticed," Sarabian said dryly.
"We definitely noticed, Your Majesty," Vanyan replied. "His Grace here turned his thinking upside down for him just a bit, though. He suggested that what the world really needs is a divine emperor or an imperial archprelacy. Both offices are incomplete as they stand."
"Me? A god? Don't be ridiculous, Amban. I've got enough problems with the government. Please don't pile a priesthood on top of it."
"I wasn't really serious, Your Majesty," Amban replied. "I just wanted to shake up his thinking a bit more. That talk you had with him opened his eyes right enough, but we still have to open his mind."
"What happened to your arm?"
Vanyan asked the woman he loved. Sophronia had just turned back her sleeve to reveal her bandaged wrist.
"I sprained it," she replied.
"On a stubborn styric head," Zelasta added, chuckling. "Sophronia!"
Vanyan stared at her.
"I used my Pandion training, dear one," she smiled. "Someone should have told me that I was supposed to lock my wrist, though."
"You actually hit someone?"
Calton asked incredulously.
"She did indeed, Sir Calton," Zelasta grinned. "She knocked him halfway across the room. She also threatened to kill him, and even went so far as to begin the death spell. He grew very cooperative at that point."
They all stared at her in disbelief.
"Oh, stop that," she told them.
Then she laughed softly.
"It was a great deal of fun, actually. I've never bullied anyone before. It's very satisfying, isn't it?"
"We like it," Uloth grinned.
"The Styrix will cooperate fully," she told them.
"How is the army?" Amban asked Tinian.
"I don't think we should expect too much there, Your Grace," Tinian replied carefully, glancing at the Emperor. "Their functions primarily ceremonial."
"They come from the very best families, Sir Knight," Sarabian said defensively.
"That might be part of the problem, Your Majesty. That and the fact that they've never had to actually fight anybody. We'll be depending on the Aetons anyway, so we won't really need the Imperial Army."
He looked at Engessa.
"Is the local garrison up to standard, Aetan Engessa?"
he asked.
"A little soft, Tinian Knight. I took them out for a run this morning, and they began to falter after 20 miles. I gave some orders. They'll be fit by the end of the week."
"Things are falling into place,"
Vanyan approved.
"The palace servants have all the usual vices, Lord Vanyan," Khalad reported. "They love to gossip. Aileen's making much better progress than I am, probably because she's prettier."
"Thank you,"
the girl murmured, lowering her eyelashes.
"It's no great compliment, Aileen," Talon told her. "My brother's not a raving beauty. None of us are. Our faces are designed for wear, not for show." "I'd guess that by the end of the week we should have gained their confidence sufficiently to start picking up secrets," Khalad surmised.
"You Aileens amaze me," Sarabian marveled. "You all seem to have an absolute genius for intrigue."
"This is a rather select group, Your Majesty," Amban told him. "We knew before we left Kyrellos that our major task here would be the gathering of information. We chose people who were skilled at it."
"I came across one of the scholars in the Contemporary Affairs Department of the University," Bevier reported. "Most of the rest of the faculty's already established reputations based on this or that past event. Resting on one's laurels is one of the failings of academics. They can coast along on a single monograph for decades. Anyway, this fellow I mentioned is young and hungry. He's come up with a theory, and he's riding it for all he's worth. He's absolutely convinced that all the present turmoil's emanating from Arjuna, perhaps because no one else on the faculty's staked out that particular ground yet. He's also convinced that Scarpa's the man behind the entire conspiracy."
"Who's Scarpa?" Calton asked.
"Zelasta told us about him," Uloth reminded him.
He serves the same function in Arjuna as Saber does in Astel and Garrick does in Lamorkand.
Oh, yes, now I remember.
Anyway, Bevier continued, our scholars gathered a huge mass of corroborating evidence, some of it very shaky. He'll talk for hours about his theory to anybody willing to listen. Is anybody else at the university working on any alternatives?
Amban asked him.
Not actively, Your Grace. They don't want to risk their reputations on false leads. Academic timidity is forcing them to take a wait-and-see position. My young enthusiast doesn't have a reputation, so he's willing to take some risks.
Stay with him, Bevier, Banyan said. Even negative conclusions can help to narrow the search.
My feelings exactly, Lord Vanyan.
Do you suppose I could impose on your majesty?
Stragan asked the emperor.
That's what a host is for, my lord,
Sarabian grinned.
Impose to your heart's content.
You did know that there are criminals here in Mathurian, didn't you?
You mean other than the members of my government?
Stragan laughed.
Score one for you, your majesty, he said. There's a world below the surface in every major city in the world, he explained. It's a world of thieves, pickpockets, burglars, beggars, whores, swindlers, and murderers. They eke out a precarious existence by preying on the rest of society.
We're aware that such people exist, of course, Sarabian said. That's why we have policemen in prisons.
Yes, Your Majesty. Those are some of the minor inconveniences in the criminal's life. What isn't generally known, however, is the fact that the criminals of the world cooperate with each other to some degree.
Go on.
I've had some contacts with those people in the past, Your Majesty,
Stragan went on, choosing his words carefully.
They can be very useful. There's almost nothing that goes on in a city that some criminal doesn't know about. If you make it clear that you're not interested in their activities, they'll usually sell you the information they've picked up.
A business arrangement?
Precisely. It's something on the order of buying stolen goods. It's not very nice, but many people do it.
Of course.
Now then, this cooperative spirit I mentioned doesn't exist here in Mathurian. Tamils don't cooperate very well for some reason. Each profession here keeps strictly to itself. They've even formed guilds, and they view other criminal professions with contempt and suspicion. We're going to have to break down those walls if those people are to be of any use to us.
That stands to reason, my lord. Stragan seemed to breathe a bit easier.
I've made some arrangements, Your Majesty, he said. The leaders of the various criminal guilds are going to come here. They respect you enormously, and they'll obey if you tell them to do something.
He paused.
That's as long as you don't command them to become honest, of course.
Of course. You can't ask a man to give up his profession, I suppose.
Exactly. What you can order them to do, though, Your Majesty, is to abandon these caste barriers and start talking to each other. If they're going to be of any use, they're going to have to be willing to pass information to one central collecting point. If we have to contact the head of each guild, information would be stale long before we got our hands on it.
I see. Correct me if I'm wrong, my lord Stragan. What you want me to do is to organize the criminals of Mathurian, so that they can prey on honest citizens more effectively, in exchange for unspecified information they may or may not be able to pick up in the street. Is that it?
Stragan winced.
I was afraid Your Majesty might look at it that way, he said.
You needn't be fearful, my lord Stragan. I'll be happy to have a chat with these loyal criminals. The gravity of the current crisis overrides my natural revulsion for having dealings with knaves and rogues. Tell me, my lord, are you a good thief?
I guess I've underestimated Your Majesty.
Stragan sighed.
Yes, actually, I'm a very good thief. I hate to sound immodest, but I'm probably the best thief in the world.
How's business?
Not so good lately, Emperor Sarabian. Times of turmoil are very bad for crime. Honest men grow nervous and start protecting their valuables. Oh, one thing, Your Majesty. The criminals you'll be addressing will all be masked. They respect you enormously, but they'll probably want to hide their faces from you.
I can understand that, I suppose. I'm rather looking forward to speaking with your friend, Stragan. We'll put our heads together and come up with ways to circumvent the authorities.
That's not really a good idea, Your Majesty,
Talon told him. Never let a thief get within 10 feet of you.
He raised his hand to show Sarabian a jeweled bracelet.
The startled emperor looked quickly at his naked right wrist. "Merely a demonstration, Your Majesty," Talon grinned. "I wasn't really going to keep it."
"Give him back the rest as well, Talon," Stragan told the boy.
Talon sighed. "Your eyes are unwholesomely sharp, Stragan." He reached inside his doublet and took out several other jewels. "The best plan is not to have anything of value on your person when you talk with thieves, Your Majesty," he advised.
"You're very good, Master Talon," Sarabian complimented the boy. "It's all in the wrist."
Talon shrugged. "I absolutely love you, Alines," Sarabian said. "Tamils are a dull, boring people, but you're full of surprises." He smiled archly at Melodir. "And what startling revelations do you have for me, Baroness?" he asked her.
"Nothing really very startling, Your Majesty," she smiled. "The swishing back and forth through the corridors has earned me several fairly predictable offers, and a fair number of pinches. Tamils pinch more than Alines, don't they? I've learned to keep my back to the wall, though. A pinch or two in the spirit of good clean fun is all right, I suppose, but the bruises take a long time to fade."
Then they all looked at Barrett. The young Pandion knight blushed furiously. "I haven't really got anything to report, my lords and ladies," he mumbled.
"Barrett," Ilana said gently, "it's not nice to lie like that, you know."
"It wasn't really anything, Your Majesty," he protested. "It was all a misunderstanding, I'm sure. Probably because I don't speak Tamil very well."
"What happened, my young friend?" Sarabian asked him.
"Well, Your Majesty, it was your wife, the Empress Elisun. The one with the unusual costume?"
"Yes, I'm acquainted with her."
"Well, Your Majesty, she approached me in one of the corridors and said that I was looking a bit tired, perhaps because I was keeping my eyes closed."
"Why were you doing that?"
"Ah, well, her costume, you understand, Your Majesty. I thought it might be impolite to stare."
"In Elisun's case, it's impolite not to. She's very proud of her attributes."
Barrett's blush deepened. "Anyway," he floundered on, "she said I looked tired and told me that she had a very comfortable bed in her quarters that I could use if I wanted to get some rest." Colton was gazing at the youthful knight with open-mouthed envy.
"What did you say?"
he asked, almost breathlessly. "Well, I thanked her, of course, but I told her that I wasn't really sleepy." Colton buried his face in his hands and groaned.
"There, there," Ulaf said, patting his shoulder comfortingly.
Chapter 27
"Well, sir, your queenship,"
Kalador was saying in his broad, colloquial drawl,
"these year trinkets is pretty things, I'll tell the world, but they ain't got no real practical use to 'em."
He offered Ilana a pair of carved ivory figurines.
"They're gorgeous, Kalador," she gushed.
"Is that guard gone?" Kaalador muttered to Sparhawk. Sparhawk nodded.
"Mirtai just shoved him out the door.
I thought he was planning to stay all day."
"Did you have any trouble getting on the grounds?" Ilana asked him.
"Not a bit, Your Majesty."
"I should hope not, after all the fuss I made."
She looked more closely at the figurines.
"These are really lovely, Kaalador," she said. "Where did you get them?"
"I had them stolen from the museum at the university." He shrugged. "They're 9th century Tegan. Very rare and very valuable."
He grinned at her impishly.
"If in your queenship's got this year passion for antiquities, you might as well get the real thing."
"I love to listen to this man talk," Ilana said.
Baroness Melodir escorted the others into the royal quarters.
"Any problems?" Stragan asked his brother thief. "Got in slicker than a weasel burrowing into a hen roost. Please, Kaalador, spare me."
Kaalador was serving the Queen of Alenia in the capacity of Procurer of Antiquities, and, by her orders, he was to be granted immediate access to her any time. One or the other of the knights had escorted him onto the grounds several times during the past several weeks in order to familiarize the guards at the gates with his face, but this was the first time he had tried to gain entry by himself. Their assorted subterfuges were growing more and more subtle.
"Has anything meaningful turned up, Master Kaalador?" Celasta asked.
I'm not entirely sure, learned one.
Kalidor frowned.
We keep running into something a little peculiar.
Oh?
All sorts of people are talking about something called the Hidden City. They're the very people we've been watching, so we thought it might have some significance.
It is a bit unusual, Zalasta agreed. It's not the sort of thing you'd expect to hear noised about on the streets.
It actually means something, then?
Zalasta nodded. It's an old Tamil platitude that has to do with the life of the mind. Are they saying, the way to the hidden city is long, but the rewards to be found there are treasures beyond price?
That's it exactly, learned one. Two people meet on the street. One of them recites the first half, and the other recites the second.
Zalasta nodded. The platitude's supposed to refer to the rewards of the search for knowledge and enlightenment. I'd suspect some other significance in this case, however. Are your people hearing it from anybody other than Tamils?
Kalidor nodded. A couple of Aline merchants greeted each other with it on a street corner just yesterday.
It sounds very much like a sign and countersign, Vanyan mused.
I'd hate to concentrate all our efforts on something like that to the exclusion of everything else, Zalasta said cautiously.
Aw, tain't no big thing, your sorcerership,
Kalidor assured him.
I'm up to my ears in beggars and whores and sneak thieves and sich. I got what you might call a embarrassment of riches in that deportment.
Zalasta looked puzzled.
He says he's got more than enough people at his disposal, Zalasta, Sifrinia translated.
It's a colorful dialect, isn't it? Zalasta observed mildly.
Ulof was frowning.
I'm not entirely positive, he said, but it seems to me that I heard two of the palace guards talking about the hidden city a few days ago. There might be more people involved than we thought.
Vanya nodded.
It may not lead anywhere, he said, but it won't hurt anything if we all keep our ears open. If Kalidor has stumbled across the password of the other side, it could help us to identify conspirators we might otherwise miss. Let's compile a sort of a list. Let's gather the names of all these people who hunger and thirst for the hidden city of the mind. If this is a sign and countersign, and if it's in any way connected to what we're looking for, let's have a group of names to work with.
You're starting to sound very much like a policeman, Lord Vanyan, Talon said, half accusingly.
Can you ever forgive me?
Oh, by the way, I saw an old friend at the university, Bevier told them with a faint smile. It seems that Baron Kotick's brother-in-law's come to Mathurian to expose the Department of Contemporary Literature to his unspeakable art.
Wouldn't inflict be a better word there, Bevier? Ulof asked. I've heard some of Elrond's poetry.
Who's Elrond? Sifrinia asked.
Sparhawk exchanged a long look with Emban. They were still bound by the oaths they had given Archimandrite Monsel.
He began, not quite sure how to proceed. He's an Astel, a sort of semi-aristocrat with literary pretensions. We're not sure just how much he's involved in the disturbances in Astel, but his opinions and sympathies seem to indicate that he's a strong supporter of the man known as Saber.
Isn't it a coincidence that he just happens to have made the trip to Mathurian at just about the same time that we're getting a strong odor of dead fish in the streets? Tinian asked. Why would he come to the very center of the culture of the godless yellow devils he professes to hate?
Unusual, Ulof agreed. Anything that's unusual is suspicious, Kalthin asserted.
That's a gross generalization, Sparhawk accused.
Well, isn't it?
In this case, you might be right. Maybe we'd better keep an eye on him. You'd better pull out your drawing pad again, Talon.
You know, Sparhawk, the boy said, I could make a lot of money drawing these pictures if you weren't so set on making a pantheon of me and saddling me with all those high ideals.
Service is its own reward, Talon, Sparhawk replied piously.
Kalidor, Sifrinia said thoughtfully.
Yes, your sorceress ship?
Please don't do that, she said wearily. There are a number of these so-called firebrands loose in Tamale. Is it at all possible that some of the local thieves might have seen any of them?
I'll ask around, Lady Sifrinia,
and I can send to the other kingdoms for people who've seen them if I have to. I'm not sure how much good physical descriptions are going to be, though. If you say that a man's sort of medium, that's going to include about half the population, almost by definition.
She can go beyond physical descriptions, Kaalador, Talon assured him. She'll wiggle her fingers at your witness and put an image of the person that they've seen in a pail of water. I can draw a picture from that.
It might not be a bad idea to have pictures of these various patriots in circulation, Sephrania murmured. If Elrond and Craeger are here, others may decide to visit Mathurin as well. If they're going to hold a convention, we should know about it, wouldn't you say?
Shouldn't you add a picture of Count Garrick as well?
Danae suggested. But he's all the way across the world in Lamorcand, Princess, Calton pointed out.
He's still one of the people involved, Calton, she said. If you're going to do something, do it right. How much is it going to cost? A few sheets of paper, maybe? And the use of Talon's pencil for a half an hour?
All right, include him. I don't care. I don't think he'll ever show up here, but go ahead and have Talon draw his picture if you want.
Oh, thank you, Calton. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Is it nearly her nap time? Calton asked sourly.
Speaking of Craeger, Sparhawk said, have there been any new sightings of him?
Just those two I mentioned earlier, Kaalador replied. Is he the kind who's likely to go to ground?
That's Craeger, all right, Calton said. He's perfectly at home with sewer rats, being at least half rat himself. As long as there was someone around to fetch wine for him, he'd be quite happy to stay down a rat hole for 6 months at a stretch.
I really want him, Kaalador, Sparhawk grated. My friends are all having a wonderful time telling me that they told me so.
I didn't follow that one, Kaalador said with a puzzled look. They all think I should have killed him. Even Sephrenia's all athirst for his blood.
Well now, friend, Kaalador drawled, I can make a real good case for just how fortunate-like it was that you didn't kill him. You and your friends here all knows this year Craeger feller, and he's some kind of high muckety-muck on t'other side. Which it is that he wouldn't have been if you'd slit his weasen. Now would he? We knows this year Craeger, and we'll chase him down sooner or later and set fire to his feet until he starts talking. If and he was to be a absolute stranger, we wouldn't have no idea at all about who we was a-looking for. Now would we?
Sparhawk smiled beatifically around at his friends.
See, he said to them, I told you I knew what I was doing.
Later that day, Sparhawk and Aelana met with Emperor Sarabian and Foreign Minister Oscania to discuss their findings to date.
Is it at all possible that anyone in the government might have noticed people using this sign and countersign, Your Excellency? Sparhawk asked Oscania.
Quite possible, Prince Sparhawk, Oscania replied. The Interior Ministry's got spies everywhere, but their reports probably won't surface for 6 months to a year. They're great paper shufflers over at Interior.
Subot's got his own spies, Sarabian said moodily. But he wouldn't tell me if he's discovered anything. I doubt that he'd tell me if someone had cut the Isle of Tiga adrift and towed it away.
All the traditions of the Prime Ministry tell him to protect you, Your Imperial Majesty, Oscania told him. Despite that little talk you had with him, you'll still probably have to pry information out of him. He devoutly believes that it's his duty to spare you the anguish of hearing unpleasant news.
If my house is on fire, I'd rather not be spared the anguish of finding out about it, Sarabian said tartly.
I have informants in the other ministries, Your Majesty. I'll put them to work on it. Speaking of that, by the way, Interior's been getting a great many reports of disturbances. Far more than we were experiencing previously. Colata's at his wit's end.
Colata? Sparhawk asked.
The Minister of the Interior, Sarabian said. The Empire's Chief of Police.
He's almost as good at keeping secrets from me as Subot is. What's afoot now, Oscania?
The graveyards have been spitting out their dead, Your Majesty. Someone's been digging up the recently deceased and reanimating them.
They shamble about moaning and blank-eyed. Whole villages in Edom have been abandoned because of them.
The werewolves are running in packs in Daconia. The vampires in the jungles of Arjuna are flocking up like migratory birds. And the Shining Ones are terrorizing the region around Dasan. Add to that the fact that the trolls are on the march in northern Aton, and that the town of Sarna has been attacked twice by what appear to be Sirgai, and we have some fair evidence that things may be coming to a head. In the past, these disturbances were sporadic and localized. Now they're becoming general. Wonderful, Sarabian said sourly. I think I'll just go into exile somewhere.
You'll miss all the fun, Your Majesty, Sparhawk told him.
What fun?
We haven't even begun to take countermeasures yet. We might not be able to do too much about vampires and the like, but we can definitely move against the trolls and the seer guy. And Geth has been training the local Aetons in certain Aline tactics. I think they might be able to deal with the trolls and the seer guy.
Sarabian looked a bit surprised. Aetan and Geth is the commander of the garrison at Cani in Astel, he said. He doesn't have any authority here in Mathirion.
As a matter of fact, he does, Your Majesty, Sparhawk disagreed. I gather that he's received a special commission from King Andril, or Queen Betuana, more than likely. Other Aetan commanders have been ordered to follow his suggestions.
Why doesn't anybody ever tell me these things?
Imperial policy, Your Majesty, Oscania smiled. If you were to know too much, you might start interfering with the government.
Anyway, Sparhawk continued, Engesa was very impressed with our tactics in the encounters we had on our way here. We've been training some of his Aetons in Western techniques.
That's surprising, Sarabian said. I wouldn't have expected Aetons to listen to anybody when it came to military matters.
Engesa's a professional, Your Majesty, Sparhawk told him. Professionals are always interested in technical advances in weaponry and tactics. We rounded up some very large draft horses so that we could mount a number of his Aetons, and Kaltan and Tinian have been giving them instruction with the lance. That's the safest way to deal with trolls, we've found. Bevier's taken another group in hand, and he's teaching them how to construct and use siege engines. When we encountered those Sirgai outside Sarsos, Bevier's catapults broke up their phalanx. It's very hard to maintain a military formation when it's raining boulders. Oh, there's something else we should be aware of. Halad found a tree outside of town that was riddled with short steel arrows. Someone's been practicing with a crossbow.
What's a crossbow? Sarabian asked.
It's a Lamorc weapon, Your Majesty.
Sparhawk scribbled a quick sketch.
It looks something like this. The limbs are much stronger than those on an ordinary longbow, so it has greater range and penetrating power. It's a serious threat to an armored knight. Someone here in Mathirion's working on a way to counter the advantage our armor gives us.
It's beginning to sound as if I'm hanging onto my throne by my fingertips, Sarabian said. Could I appeal to you for political asylum, Elana?
I'd be delighted to have you, Sarabian, she replied. But let's not give up on Sparhawk just yet. He's terribly resourceful.
As I was saying before, Sparhawk continued, we can't do too much about the ghouls or werewolves or the Shining Ones or vampires. But I think we might be able to give the trolls and the seer guy a few surprises. I'd like for the Aetons to have a bit more training with mounted tactics and the use of Bevier's engines. And then I think it might be time to let our opponent know that he's not going to win this in a walk. I'd particularly like to decimate the trolls. Our enemy's relying rather heavily on the troll gods, and they'll leave the alliance if too many of their worshippers get killed. I think that early next week we might want to mount a couple of expeditions, one up into Troll Country, and another down to Sarna. It's time to make our presence known.
And this local business? Oscania asked. All this fascination with the hidden city of the mind?
Calador will keep working on that. We've got their password now, and that can open all kinds of doors for us. Vanyan's drawing up a list of names. Before long, we'll know everybody in Mathirion who's been talking about the hidden city.
He looked at Sarabian.
Have I Your Majesty's permission to detain those people if necessary? He asked.
If we move first and round them all up before they can set their scheme in motion, we'll break the back of this plot before it gets too far along.
Detain away, Sparhawk, Sarabian grinned. I've lots of buildings we can use for prisons.
All right, young lady, Sparhawk said quite firmly to his daughter a few days later. One of Kaalador's beggars saw Count Garrick in the street not far from here.
How did you know that he'd be here in Matherian?
I didn't know, Sparhawk. I just had a hunch.
Danae was sitting calmly in a large chair, scratching her cat's ears. Murr was purring gratefully.
A hunch?
Intuition, if that word makes you feel any better. It just didn't seem right that Krager and Elrond would be here without the others being here as well. And that would logically include Garrick, wouldn't it?
Don't confuse the issue by using the words logic and intuition in the same sentence.
Oh, Sparhawk, do grow up. That's all that logic really is, a justification for hunches. Have you ever known anyone who used logic to disprove something he already believed?
Well, not personally, maybe, but I'm sure there have been some.
I'll wait while you track one down. I'm an immortal, so time doesn't really mean all that much to me.
That's really offensive, Afriel.
Sorry, Father. She didn't sound very contrite. Your mind gathers information in hundreds of ways, Sparhawk. Things you hear, things you see, things you touch, and even things you smell. Then it puts all of that information together and jumps from there to a conclusion. That's all that hunches really are. Intuition is just as precise as logic, really. But it doesn't have to go through the long, tedious process of plodding along step by step to prove things. It leaps immediately from evidence to conclusion, without all the tiresome intermediate steps. Sophronia doesn't like logic because it's so boring. She already knows the answers you're so laboriously trying to prove. And so do you, if you'd be honest about it.
Folklore is full of these hunches, Afriel, and they're usually wrong. How about the old notion that thunder sours milk?
That's a mistake in logic, Sparhawk, not a mistake in intuition.
Would you like to explain that?
You could just as easily say that sour milk causes thunder, you know.
That's absurd.
Of course it is. Thunder and sour milk are both effects, not causes.
You should talk to Dolmot. I'd like to see you try to explain that he's been wasting his time on logic all these years.
He already knows.
She shrugged.
Dolmot's far more intuitive than you give him credit for being. He knew who I was the moment he saw me, which is a lot more than I can say for you, Father. I thought for a while there that I was going to have to fly in order to persuade you.
Be nice.
I am. There are all sorts of things I didn't say about you. What's Krager up to?
Nobody knows.
We really need to find him, Sparhawk.
I know. I want him even more than you do. I'm going to enjoy wringing him out like a wet sock.
Be serious, Sparhawk. You know Krager. He'd tell you his whole life story if you even frowned at him.
He sighed. You're probably right, he conceded. It takes a lot of the fun out of it, though.
You're not here to have fun, Sparhawk. Which would you rather have, information or revenge?
Couldn't we come up with a way to have both?
She rolled her eyes upward.
Aline's.
She sighed. Bevier took a detachment of newly trained Aton engineers west toward Sarna early the next week. The following day, Calton, Tinian, and Engessa took 200 mounted Aetons north toward the lands being ravaged by the trolls. At Vanyan's insistence, the parties filtered out of Matherian in twos and threes to assemble later outside the city.
"There's no point in announcing what we're up to," he said.
A few days after the departure of the two military expeditions, Zelasta left for Sarsos.
"I won't be very long," he told them. "We have a certain commitment from the Thousand, but I think I'd like to see some concrete evidence that they're willing to honor that commitment. Words are all well and good, but let's see some action, just as a demonstration of good faith. I know my brothers. Nothing in the world would please them more than being able to reap the benefits of allying themselves with us in principle, without the inconvenience of actually being obliged to do anything to help. They're best suited to deal with these supernatural manifestations, so I'll pry them loose from their comfortable chairs in Sarsos and disperse them to these trouble spots." He smiled thinly at Vanyan from under his beetling brows. "Extensive travel might toughen them up a bit, my lord," he added. "Perhaps we can avoid spraining any more of your ankles in demonstrations of how flabby and lazy they are."
"I appreciate that, Zelasta," Vanyan laughed.
There were always more things to do than there was time for. The ceremonies and occasions that surrounded the state visit by the Queen of Alenia filled their afternoons and evenings, and so Sparhawk and the others were obliged to work late and rise early in order to conduct their surreptitious operations in the city and the imperial compound. They all grew short-tempered from lack of sleep, and Mirtai began to badger Sparhawk about the condition of his wife's health. Elana was, in fact, beginning to develop dark circles under her eyes and an increasingly waspish disposition. The breakthrough came about 10 days after the departure of the expeditions to Sarna and to the newly occupied lands of the trolls. Ka'alador arrived early one morning with a kind of exultant tightness of his face and a large canvas sack in one hand. "It was pure luck, Sparhawk," he chortled when the two met in the royal apartment. "We're due for some," Sparhawk told him. "What did you find?" "How would you like to know the exact day and hour when this hidden city business is going to come to a head?"
"I'd be moderately interested in that, yes."
"That self-congratulatory expression spread all over your face says that you've found out a few things."
"I have indeed, Sparhawk, and it fell into my hand like an overripe peach."
Ka'alador slid into his drawl.
"Them there fellers on t'other side's mighty careless with wrote-down instructions. It seems that this year cut-purse of my acquaintance, enterprising young feller with a real sharp knife, he slid open the purse of this year fat Dacite merchant, and a whole fistful of coins come slithering out. And mixed in with them there silver and brass coins, they was this year message, which it was as had been passed on to him by one of his feller conspiraciers."
Ka'alador frowned.
"Maybe the right word there would have been conspirators," he mused.
"Elana's still in bed, Ka'alador," Sparhawk told him. "You don't have to entertain me with that dialect."
"Sorry, just keeping in practice.
Anyway, the note was quite specific. It said, 'The day of the revelation of the hidden city is at hand. All is in readiness. We will come to your warehouse for the arms at the second hour past sunset, 10 days hence.' Isn't that interesting?"
"It is indeed, Ka'alador. But the note could be a week old."
"No, actually it's not. Would you believe that the idiot who wrote it actually dated it?"
"You're not serious."
"May my tongue turn green if I ain't.
Can your cut-purse identify this Dacite merchant? I'd like to locate this warehouse and find out what kind of arms are stored there."
"I'm way ahead of you, Sparhawk," Ka'alador grinned. "We tracked down the Dacite, and I called on my vast experience as a chicken rustler to get inside his storehouse." He opened the large bag he had brought with him and took out what appeared to be a newly made crossbow. "They was several hundred of these in that there hen roost of his'n," he said, "along with a whole passel of cheap swords, which was most likely forged in Libros in Camoria, which it is that's notorious for making shoddy goods for trade with backward folk."
Sparhawk turned the crossbow over in his hands. "It's not really very well made, is it?" he noted.
"She'll probably shoot, though. Wants it, anyway."
"This explains that tree Halad found with all the crossbow bolts stuck in it. It looks as if we've been anticipated. Our friend out there wouldn't really need crossbows unless he knew he was going to come up against men in armor. The longbow's a lot more efficient against ordinary people. It shoots faster."
"I think we'd better face up to something, Sparhawk," Ka'alador said gravely. "Several hundred crossbows means several hundred conspirators, not counting the ones who'll be using the swords. And that's fair evidence that the conspiracy's going to involve unpleasantness here in Matherian itself, as well as out there in the hinterlands. I think we'd better be prepared for a mob, and for fighting in the streets."
"You could very well be right, my friend. Let's see what we can do to defang that mob."
He went to the door and opened it. As usual, Mirtai sat outside with her sword in her lap.
"Could you get Halad for me, Etana?" he asked politely.
"Who's going to guard the door while I'm gone?"
she asked him.
"I'll take care of it."
"Why don't you go get him? I'll stay here and see to Elana's safety."
He sighed.
"Please, Mirtai, as a special favor to me."
"If anything happens to Elana while I'm gone, you'll answer to me, Sparhawk.
I'll keep that in mind.
Pretty girl, isn't she? Kaalador noted after the giantess had gone in search of Sparhawk's squire.
I wouldn't make a point of noticing that too much when Kring's around, my friend. They're betrothed, and he's the jealous type.
Should I say she's ugly, then?
That wouldn't really be a good idea, either. If you do that, she'll probably kill you.
Touchy, aren't they?
Oh, yes, both of them. Theirs promises to be a very lively marriage.
Mirtai returned with Khalad a few minutes later.
You sent for me, my lord?
Kirik's son asked.
How would you go about disabling this crossbow without making it obvious that it had been tampered with? Sparhawk asked, handing the young man the weapon Kaalador had brought with him.
Khalad examined the weapon.
Cut the string almost all the way through. Up here where it's attached to the end of the bow, he suggested. It'd break as soon as anyone tried to draw it.
Sparhawk shook his head.
They might load the weapons in advance, he said. Someone's going to try to use these on us, I think, and I don't want him to find out that they don't work until it's too late.
I could break the trigger mechanism, Khalad said. The bowman could draw it and load it, but he couldn't shoot it. At least he couldn't aim it at the same time.
Would it stay cocked until he tried to shoot it?
Probably. This isn't a very well-made crossbow, so he won't expect it to work very well. All you'd have to do is drive out the pin that holds the trigger in place and stick short steel pegs in the holes to hide the fact that the pin's gone. There's a spring that holds the bow drawn, but without the pin to provide leverage, the trigger won't release that spring. They'll be able to draw it, but they won't be able to shoot it.
I'll take your word for it. How long would it take you to put this thing out of action?
A couple of minutes.
You've got a few long nights ahead of you then, my friend. There are several hundred of these to deal with, and you're going to have to do it quietly and in poor light. Kaalador, can you slip my friend here into the Dacite merchant's warehouse?
If and he can move around sort of quiet like I can.
I think he can manage. He's a country boy the same as you are, and I'd guess that he's almost as skilled at making rabbit snares and stealing chickens.
Sparhawk,
Khalad protested.
Those skills are too valuable to have been left out of your education, Khalad. And I knew your father, remember?
They knew we were coming, Sparhawk, Kalton said angrily. We split up into two small groups and stayed away from the towns and villages, and they still knew we were coming.
They ambushed us on the west shore of Lake Sama.
Trolls? Sparhawk's voice was tense. Worse. It was a large group of rough-looking fellows armed with crossbows. They made the mistake of shooting all at the same time. If they hadn't, none of us would have made it back to tell you about it. They decimated Engesa's mounted Atons, though. He was seriously put out about that. He tore quite a number of the ambushers apart with his bare hands. A sudden cold fear gripped Sparhawk's stomach.
"Where's Tinian?" he asked. "He's in the care of a physician. He caught a bolt in the shoulder, and it broke some things in there.
Is he going to be all right?"
"Probably. It didn't improve his temper very much, though. He uses his sword almost as well with his left hand as he does with his right. We had to restrain him when the ambushers broke free and ran. He was going to chase them down one by one, and he was bleeding like a stuck pig. I think we've got spies here in this imitation castle, Sparhawk. Those people couldn't have laid that ambush without some fairly specific information about our route and our destination."
"We'll sweep those hiding places again."
"Good idea. And this time let's do a bit more with the ones we catch than reprimand them for bad manners. A spy can't creep through hidden passages very well with two broken legs."
The blonde Pandion's face was grim.
"I get to do the breaking," he added. "I want to be sure that there aren't any miraculous recoveries. A broken shin bone heals in a couple of months. But if you take a sledgehammer to a man's knees, you'll put him out of action for much, much longer."
Bevier, who led the survivors of his detachment back into Mathurian 2 days later, took Colton's suggestion a step further. His notion involved amputations at the hip. The devout Cyrenic knight was very angry about being ambushed, and he used language Sparhawk had never heard from him before. When he had calmed himself finally, though, he contritely sought absolution from Patriarch Emban. Emban not only forgave him, but granted an indulgence as well, just in case he happened across some new swear words. A thorough search of the opalescent castle turned up no hidden listeners, and they all gathered to confer with Emperor Sarabian and Foreign Minister Oscania the day after Sir Bevier's return. They met high in the central tower, just to be on the safe side, and Sophronia added a steric spell to further ensure that their discussions would remain private.
"I'm not accusing anyone," Vanyan said, "so don't take this personally. Word of our plans is somehow leaking out, so I think we should all pledge that no hint of what we discuss here should leave this room."
"An oath of silence, Lord Vanyan?" Calton seemed surprised. That Pandion tradition had fallen into disuse in the past century.
"Well," Vanyan amended, "something on that order, I suppose. But we're not all Pandion knights here, you know."
He looked around.
"All right, then. Let's summarize the situation. The plot here in Mathurian quite obviously goes beyond simple espionage. I think we'd better face up to the probability of an armed insurrection directed at the Imperial compound. Our enemy seems to be growing impatient."
"Or fearful," Oscania added. "The presence of Church Knights and Prince Sparhawk here in Mathurian poses some kind of threat. His campaign of random terror, civil disturbance, and incipient insurrection in the subject kingdoms was working fairly well, but it appears that something's come up that makes that process too slow. He has to strike at the center of Imperial authority now."
"And directly at me, I gather," Emperor Sarabian added.
"That's unthinkable, Your Majesty," Oscania objected. "In all the history of the Empire, no one ever directly confronted the Emperor."
"Please, Oscania," Sarabian said, "don't treat me like an idiot. Any number of my predecessors have met with accidents or fallen fatally ill under peculiar circumstances. Inconvenient emperors have been removed before."
"But never right out in the open, Your Majesty. That's terribly impolite." Sarabian laughed.
"I'm sure that the three government ministers who threw my great-great-grandfather from the top of the highest tower in the compound were all exquisitely courteous about it, Oscania. We're going to have an armed mob in the streets, then, all enthusiastically howling for my blood?" "I wouldn't discount the possibility, Your Majesty," Vanyan conceded.
"I hate this," Ulof said sourly.
"Hate what?" Calton asked him. "Isn't it obvious? We've got an Aline castle here. It might not be quite as good as one that Bevier would have designed, but it's still the strongest building in Mathurian. We've got 3 days until the streets are going to be filled with armed civilians. We don't have much choice. We have to pull back inside these walls, fort up until the Aetons can restore order. I detest sieges."
"I'm sure we won't have to go that far, Sir Ulof," Oscania protested. "As soon as I heard about that message Master Kaalador unearthed, I sent word to Norcan in Aetana. There are 10,000 Aetons massed 20 leagues from here. The conspirators aren't going to move until after dark on the appointed day. I can have the streets awash with 7-foot-tall Aetons before noon of that same day. The attempted coup will fail before it ever gets started."
"And miss the chance to round them all up?" Ulof said. "Very poor military thinking, Your Excellency. We've got a defensible castle here. Bevier could hold this place for 2 years at least."
5, Bevier corrected. "There's a well inside the walls. That adds 3 years."
"Even better," Ulof said. "We work on our fortifications here very quietly, and mostly at night. We bring in barrels of pitch and naphtha. Bevier builds siege engines. Then, just before the sun goes down, we move the entire government and the regular Aeton garrison inside the castle. The mob will storm the Imperial compound and rage through the halls of all these impressive buildings on the grounds. They won't encounter any resistance until they come here. They'll try to storm our walls, and they'll be overconfident because nobody will have tried to fight them in any of the other buildings. They won't really be expecting a hailstorm of large boulders or sheets of boiling pitch dumped in their faces. Add to that the fact that their crossbows won't work because Khalad's been breaking the triggers in the Dakite warehouse for the last 2 nights, and you've got a large group of people with a serious problem.
They'll mill around out there in confusion and chagrin, and then, probably about midnight, the new detachment of Etons will enter the city, come to the Imperial compound, and grind the whole lot of them right into the ground.
Yes, Engessa exclaimed enthusiastically.
It's a brilliant plan, Sir Ulaf, Sarabian told the big Thalesian. Why are you so dissatisfied with it?
Because I don't like sieges, Your Majesty.
Ulaf, Tinian said, wincing slightly as he shifted his broken shoulder, don't you think it's time that you abandoned this pose? You're as quick to suggest forting up as any of the rest of us when the situation calls for it.
The Legions are supposed to hate sieges, Tinian. It's a part of our national character. We're supposed to be impetuous, impatient, and more inclined toward brute force than toward well-considered endurance.
Sir Ulaf, Bevier said, smiling slightly, King Wargan's father endured a siege at Hyde that lasted for 17 years. He emerged from it none the worse for wear.
Yes, but did he enjoy it, Bevier? That's my point.
I think we're overlooking an opportunity, my friends,
Kryn noted.
The mob's going to come to the Imperial compound, right?
If we've guessed their intentions correctly, yes, Tinian agreed.
Some of them are going to be all afire with political fervor, but not really very many, I don't think. Most of them are going to be more interested in looting the various palaces.
Sarabian's face blanched. Helen Knight, he swore. I hadn't even thought of that.
Don't be too concerned, friend Emperor, the Domi told him. Whether it's politics or greed that brings them, they'll almost all come into the grounds. The walls around the compound are high, and the gates very imposing. Why don't we let them come in? But then make sure they don't leave. I can hide men near the gatehouse. After the mob's on the grounds, we'll close the gates. That should keep them all more or less on hand to greet the Etons when they arrive. The loot will bring them in, and the gates will keep them in. They'll loot right enough, but loot isn't really yours until you've escaped with it. We'll catch them all this way, and we won't have to dig any of them out of rabbit holes later.
That's got real possibilities, you know that, Crank?
Calton said admiringly.
I'd have expected no less of him, Murtai said. He is a brilliant warrior, after all, and my betrothed.
Kryn beamed.
One last touch, perhaps, Stragan added. I think we all have a burning curiosity about certain things, and we've compiled this list of names of people who might have answers to some of our most urgent questions. Battles are chancy, and sometimes valuable people get killed. I think there are some out there in Mathurian who should be removed to safety before the fighting starts.
Good idea, my lord Stragan, Sarabian agreed. I'll send out some detachments on the morning of the big day to round up those we'd like to keep alive.
Perhaps that might not be the best way to go at it, Your Majesty. Why not let Ka'alador attend to it? As a group, policemen tend to be obvious when they arrest people. Uniforms, chains, marching in step, that sort of thing. Professional murderers are much more unobtrusive. You don't have to put chains on a man when you arrest him. A dagger point held discreetly to his side is just as effective, I've found.
Sarabian gave him a shrewd look. You're speaking from experience, I gather, he speculated.
Murder is a crime, Your Majesty, Stragan pointed out. And as a leader of criminals, I should have some experience in all branches of the field. Professionalism, you understand.
Chapter 28. It was definitely Scarpa, Sparhawk, Ka'alador assured the big Pandion. We didn't have to rely entirely on the drawing. One of the local whores is from Arjuna, and she's had business dealings with him in the past. She positively identified him. The two of them were standing atop the castle wall, where they could speak privately.
That seems to be everybody but Baron Perak of Daconia, then, Sparhawk noted. We've seen Krager, Garrick, Rebal of Edom, this Scarpa from Arjuna, and Elrond from Astel.
I thought the conspirator from Astel was called Saber, Ka'alador said. Sparhawk silently cursed his careless tongue.
Saber keeps his face hidden, he said. Elrond's a sympathizer. More than that, probably.
Kaalador nodded. I've known some Astels, he agreed, and some Dakites, too. I wouldn't be positive that Baron Perok's not lurking in the shadows somewhere. They're definitely all gathering here in Metherion.
He looked thoughtfully out over the gleaming nacreous battlements at the foss below.
Is that ditch down there going to be all that much of a barrier? He asked. The sides are so gently sloped that there's a lawn growing on them.
It gets more inconvenient when it's filled with sharpened stakes, Sparhawk replied. We'll do that at the last minute.
Has there been any influx of strangers into Metherion?
All those assorted patriots have large followings. A mob gathered off the streets is one thing, but a horde drawn from most of Tomalley would be something else entirely.
We haven't seen any unusual number of strangers here in town, Kaalador said, and there aren't any large gatherings out in the countryside, at least not within 5 leagues in any direction.
They could be holding in place farther out, Sparhawk said. If I had a supporting army out there someplace, I wouldn't bring them in until the last minute.
Kaalador turned and looked pointedly at the harbor. That's our weakness right there, Sparhawk. There could be a fleet hiding in coves and inlets along the coast. We'd never see them coming until they showed up on the horizon. I've got pirates and smugglers scouring the coasts, but... He spread his hands.
There's not very much we can do about it, I'm afraid, Sparhawk said. We've got an army of Aetons close at hand, though, and they'll be inside the city soon after the uprising starts. Do your people have the hiding places of these assorted visitors fairly well pinpointed? If things go well, I'd like to sweep them all up at once, if possible.
They don't seem to have lighted in specific places yet, Sparhawk. They're all moving around quite a bit. I've got people following them. We could pick them up early if you'd like.
Let's not expose our preparations. If we can catch them on the day of the uprising, fine. If not, we can chase them down later. I'm not going to endanger our countermeasures just for the pleasure of their company.
Your people are doing very well, Kaalador.
Their performance is a bit forced, my friend, Kaalador admitted ruefully. I've had to gather a large number of burly ruffians with clubs to keep reminding the Tamil criminals that we're all working together in this affair.
Whatever it takes.
Her Majesty's suggestion has some advantages, Lord Vanyan, Bevier said after giving it some thought. It's what the foss was designed for originally, anyway. It's supposed to be a moat. Not just a grassy ditch.
It completely exposes the fact that we're preparing to defend the castle, Bevier, Vanyan objected. If we start pumping the moat full of water, everybody in Metherion will know about it within the hour.
You didn't listen to the whole plan, Vanyan, Elana said patiently. We've been attending balls and banquets and various other entertainments ever since we arrived here. It's only proper that I respond to all those kindnesses. So I'm planning a grand entertainment to pay my social obligations. It's not my fault that it's going to take place on the night of the uprising, is it? We have an Aline castle, so we'll have an Aline party. We'll have an orchestra on the battlements, colored lanterns and buntings on the walls, and festive barges in the moat, complete with canopies and banquet tables. I'll invite the Emperor and his whole court.
That would be extremely convenient, Lord Vanyan, Tinian said. We'd have everybody we want to protect right close at hand. We wouldn't have to go looking for them, and we wouldn't alert anybody to what we're doing by chasing cabinet ministers across the lawns.
Sparhawk's squire was shaking his head. What is it, Halad? Elana asked him.
The bottom of the ditch hasn't been prepared to hold water, Your Majesty. We don't know how porous the subsoil is. There's a very good chance that the water you pump in will just seep into the ground. Your moat could be empty again a few hours after you fill it.
Oh, bother, Elana fretted. I didn't think of that. I'll take care of it, Elana, Sophrenia smiled. A good plan shouldn't be abandoned just because it violates a few natural laws.
Would you have to do that before we started to fill the moat, Sophrenia?
Stragan asked her. It's easier that way, he frowned. What's the problem? She asked.
There are those 3 tunnels that lead under the foss to connect with the hidden passageways and listening posts inside the castle.
3 that we know about, anyway, Uloth added.
Exactly my point. Wouldn't we all feel more secure if all those tunnels, the ones we know about and the ones we don't,
are flooded before the fighting starts?
Good point, Sparhawk said.
I can wait to seal the bottom of the moat until after you've flooded the tunnels, Sifrinia told them.
What do you think, Vanyan? Amban asked.
The preparations for the Queen's party would cover a lot of activity,
Vanyan conceded.
It's a very good plan.
I like all of it except the barges, Sparhawk said. I'm sorry, Aelana, but those barges would just give the mob access to our walls. They'd defeat the whole purpose the moat was designed for in the first place.
I'm getting to that, Sparhawk. Doesn't naphtha float on top of water?
Yes, but what's that got to do with it?
A barge isn't just a floating platform, you know. It's got a hold under the deck. Now suppose we fill the holds with casks of naphtha. Then, when the trouble starts, we throw boulders down from the battlements and crack the barges open like eggshells. The naphtha will spread out over the water in the moat. We set fire to it and surround the castle with a wall of flame. Wouldn't that sort of inconvenience people trying to attack the castle?
You're a genius, my queen, Carlton exclaimed.
How nice of you to have noticed that, Sir Carlton, she replied smugly. And the beautiful part about the whole thing is that we can make all of our preparations right out in the open, without sneaking around at night and losing all that sleep. This grand party gives us the perfect excuse to do almost anything to the castle in the name of decoration.
Mirtai suddenly embraced her owner and kissed her.
I'm proud of you, my mother, she said. I'm glad you approve, my daughter, Aelana said modestly. But you really ought to be more reserved, you know. Remember what you told me about girls kissing girls?
We found two more tunnels, Sparhawk, Khalad reported as his lord joined him on the parapet.
Khalad was wearing a canvas smock over his black leather vest. Sparhawk looked out at the moat where a gang of workmen was driving long steel rods into the soft earth at the bottom of the ditch.
Isn't that a little obvious? He asked. We have to have mooring stakes for the barges, don't we? The tunnels are all about 5 feet below the surface. Most of the workmen with the sledgehammers don't know what they're really looking for, but I've got a fair number of knights down in the ditch with them. The ceilings of those tunnels will be very leaky when we start to fill the moat.
Khalad looked out across the lawn.
Then he cupped his hands around his mouth.
Be careful with that barge, he bellowed in Tamil. If you spring our seams, she'll leak.
The foreman of the Tamil work crew, laboriously pulling the broad-beamed barge across the lawn on rollers, looked up.
It's very heavy, honored sir, he called back. What have you got inside of it?
Ballast, you idiot, Khalad called back. There are going to be a lot of people on that deck tomorrow night. If the barge capsizes and the Emperor falls in the moat, we'll all be in trouble.
Sparhawk looked inquiringly at his squire.
We are putting the naphtha casks in the barges inside the construction sheds, Khalad explained. We decided to do that more or less in private.
He looked at his lord.
You don't necessarily have to tell your wife I said this, Sparhawk, he said. But there were a few gaps in her plan. The naphtha was a good idea, as far as it went. But we've added some pitch as well, just to make sure it catches on fire when we want it to. Naphtha casks are also very tight. They won't do us much good if they just sink to the bottom of the moat when we break open the barges. I'm going to put a couple of Kring's Poloi in the hold of each barge. They'll take axes to the casks at the last minute.
You think of everything, Khalad.
Somebody has to be practical in this group.
Now you sound like your father.
There is one thing, though, Sparhawk. Your partygoers are going to have to be very, very careful. There'll be lanterns, and probably candles as well, on those barges. One little accident could start the fire quite a bit sooner than we'd planned, and, actually, we're a bit ahead of schedule, Your Highness,
he said in Tamil, for the benefit of the half-dozen laborers who were pulling a two-wheeled cart along the parapet. End of Side 11. To continue, turn the cassette over.